Until the Crusades, Europe had been a primitive backwater, isolated from other civilizations and lost in a dark age that had descended on Western Christendom after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century. By the end of the crusading venture, Europe had not only recovered, but also was on a course to overtake its rivals and achieve world hegemony. So wrote Karen Armstrong in the New York Times Magazine. And the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East are sometimes referred to as a continuation of the struggle between Muslims and the Crusaders. So, what was the purpose of the Crusades in the first place, and after all that, what did they accomplish? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We'll get some answers from my guest, Elizabeth Lapina, a professor of history at the UW-Madison and author of Warfare and the Miraculous in the Chronicles of the First Crusade. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We go back 1,000 years. There are some dates that stand out after all this time. And one of them is 1066, which, of course, is the Norman conquest of England. But then, just a generation later, the Crusades started. Is there any kind of connection between those events?
If I may, I would like to disagree with the quotation you quoted.
Oh, good.
In the beginning. Europe was never disconnected from the rest of the world. So around the time of 1066, late 11th century, before the Crusades take place, if you were an English knight, say, you had many choices, and one of the choices you had was to go to Constantinople, today's Istanbul, and serve in the army of the Byzantine Emperor. And this is before the Crusades. And we know that many people went and many people came back. And we know that they brought money with them, money they made abroad, because we found lots of coins, Byzantine coins, that predate the Crusading period. So this is just as an introduction. 1066... Yeah, the Norman conquest of England. 1099, the conquest of Jerusalem, when Western knights conquered the shores of the Mediterranean from what today is Turkey to Jerusalem, almost to today's Egypt. So one thing that was really different is that knights were supposed to feel bad about the conquest of England. And I explain what I mean. They knew that the war was just, that their cause was just, that William the Conqueror had the right to the throne of England. But the fact that they fought, that they shed blood, this was seen as something sinful, as something that a good Christian should not do. So ecclesiastical authorities actually came up with penances for those knights who fought at Hastings. So if they killed somebody, they would have to fast on bread and water for so many days. If they thought they killed somebody, well, not sure, they would fast for a shorter period. And everything was very, very different with Crusades. Crusaders were not supposed to feel bad about killing the enemies.
Were these the same people, though, pretty much? Knights?
They're sons. Many of the sons of those who fought at Hastings, yeah, they went on the Crusades. But the war was radically different. They believed that they were soldiers of Christ. They called themselves Militus Christi, soldiers of Christ. And they believed that they were fighting Christ's battles and that Christ was going to reward them for their efforts in killing the infidel with a place in paradise. So quite a shift between 1066 and 1099 in that respect.
I assume then, by what you're saying, Elizabeth, that there was no thought of trying to convert these Muslims.
This is a complicated question that historians are still debating. But during the First Crusade, what they cared most about, Crusaders, was not so much Muslims, but what they cared about was the land and the stones, the Holy Land. The Holy Land where Christ walked, and especially the buildings of Jerusalem, and one particular building, the Holy Sepulchre. So the Sepulchre of Christ, where Christ was buried and from which he has risen. So Muslims were on the back burner for them. Eventually, yes, they became interested in conversion of Muslims, but their goal was to take over the Holy Sepulchre. And the interesting fact is that Jerusalem was in Muslim hands for 4 centuries by the time of the First Crusade. And for the most part, Muslims were okay with pilgrims, with Western visitors, who went to Jerusalem, who prayed at the Holy Sepulchre, and who went back home. But 1095, it was decided this was no longer tolerable and that Holy Sepulchre has to be in Christian hands. Hence the first Crusade. So Muslims were not that important at the time. But they were important because they were there. They were the people who got slaughtered on July 15th, 1099, when Crusaders took Jerusalem. It was a very violent siege and a very violent takeover, a massacre that lasted several days. So Muslims were killed there, but Crusaders cared the most about the actual stones.
Who actually authorized the Crusade? And then once it was authorized, who recruited?
It was the papacy, Pope Urban II, who preached the Crusades. Another important actor was the Byzantine Emperor Alexius, who asked for mercenaries. But Alexius was asking for mercenaries to fight under him, to do whatever he commanded them to do, because Byzantines relied on Western mercenaries, like I mentioned in the beginning, to fight their wars. So Alexius wrote to the Pope and said, I would like some knights. What he got was 100,000 people who didn't know who he was, didn't care about Byzantium, who wanted to capture Jerusalem. Recruitment process, Urban II, well, first of all, he traveled around different lands and preached the Crusades there, and he sent delegates to preach as well. And this just spread through word of mouth all over Europe.
The Crusaders then and the Knights, they had to make some adjustments in terms of becoming what, worthy as Crusaders? How did the two codes of ethics compare?
Well, there was a theory and there was a practice. In theory, for example, women were not supposed to go on Crusades. Of course, women went on Crusades. About 20% of Crusaders were women. So it was supposed to be an all-male enterprise. It was not. Crusaders were supposed to adhere to much higher moral standards. They were not supposed to do things like gambling, not supposed to have pointy shoes. We have some records of them being forbidden from having luxurious.
Oh, just because those were considered
over the top. Yeah, they were supposed to temporarily become like monks, like the religious who abandon the world. Of course, this did not work out exactly in this way.
Well, I'm thinking of a comparison which might not be valid because it actually occurs some 400 years later. But when Columbus came to the New World, he was castigated, punished by the church authorities because he slew rather than converted the Native Americans. But this doesn't seem to have been an issue in Byzantium, Constantinople. They get there July 15th, 1099, and they're just, hacking people up.
Yeah, the goal was to conquer the land, and we have sources that celebrate crusaders purifying the city. Purifying the city by getting rid of the population, by slaughtering it. And actually, it's quite difficult to read some of the chronicles of the First Crusade that describe infants being slaughtered, women being slaughtered, old men being slaughtered. So civilians being killed in this city to purify the city of the infidels. Conversion came a bit later when, for example, Saint Francis of Assisi, so one of the most popular medieval saints, he actually went to Egypt, and he tried to convert the Sultan there. And this was happened during the time of the Fifth Crusade. So Crusade was going on there. So it was hostilities were going on, and Saint Francis crossed the lines and went to the Sultan to convert him to Christianity, and. What he wanted was to get killed, to be martyred for his faith. Because you're not supposed to preach a different religion to a sultan. But the sultan was very kind, and he let them go. So he didn't, Saint Francis did not achieve his aim of either converting or suffering martyrdom. So conversion was a bit of a sideshow with the Crusades.
And I gather not terribly successful, given the way things played out. I mean, it was just a matter of conflict. Now, are there two Christian churches at this point, Eastern and Western?
Just to go back to conversion, even though conversion did not occur, we have many instances of people converting. In all different directions. We have some examples, or at least one example, of a Latin Christian, a Western Christian, converting to Judaism in the Holy Land, because he decided that this was the way to go. We have Muslims converting. We have Christians converting. So conversion was going on, but there was no mass effort to convert Muslims.
As far as the two churches, though, I mean, there was a point in which there was a kind of a unified Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. but did it not split when in the 11th century? You had an Eastern Church that was centered Eastern Mediterranean, then a Western Church centered in Rome?
Yes, there were two big churches. So Catholic Church with the papacy at its head and Eastern Orthodox Church. Which did not recognize the Pope. But we also have a lot of smaller churches, the Armenians, the Jacobites. So the Middle East was and is today really a mosaic of different communities, including different Christian communities, different Muslim communities as well, Jewish communities. So the picture is actually very, very, very complex.
Who was actually defending Jerusalem? From a jurisdictional standpoint, was it in a country? Was it in some kind of a religious caliph? Or what was the status of it?
Jerusalem actually was a frontier town. It was very important from the religious perspective. It was not particularly important either economically or militarily. It was on the frontier between the lands ruled by the Sunni Muslims and the lands ruled by a Shia Fatimid dynasty of Egypt. And it switched hands several times between the Sunnis and the Shia. And the Sunnis and the Shia really did not like each other at the time. So actually, when Crusaders came over, some of the Sunni Muslims believed they were allies of the Shia, and that they were opening a second front against the Sunnis. Of course, Crusaders were not doing that. Most of them had no idea about the difference between the Sunnis and the Shia. So when Crusaders took over Jerusalem, it was the Fatimid dynasty who owned Jerusalem and who defended Jerusalem. So the garrison obeyed the orders of the Sultan in Cairo.
What was the significance of Jerusalem for Islam?
It's very important because the Quran, it doesn't mention Jerusalem, but it mentions the furthest mosque. And the furthest mosque is usually interpreted as being located in Jerusalem. And it's the place where Prophet Muhammad miraculously traveled and from which he ascended to heaven during his lifetime. To heaven where he met the prophets of the Old Testament and also where he met, according to the Quran, where he met Jesus as well. So it's a holy site because of that, because of the connections with Muhammad, and also all the Old Testament traditions. They became integrated into Christianity and also Islam. Abraham tried to sacrifice Isaac in Jerusalem. So this is this as well adds to the sanctity of Jerusalem for Christians and Muslims.
Did they have any kind of warning that these crusaders were coming to take over the town in 1099?
They had some idea, but crusades were not terribly important for the Muslim world in general. The Mongols were important. The Mongols were very, very important. Coming from the east. But this entire coast was backwaters for the Muslim world. What mattered happened in Damascus or Baghdad, further east. That was the center of power. So having Jerusalem, not having Jerusalem, was not militarily crucial to them, was not central to them. Also, Muslim world through much of the crusading period was divided. So I mentioned one of those divides between Sunnis and Shia. And we also have a newcomer in the region, Seljuk Turks, who invaded in the 11th century. So adding to the complexity of the story. So there was no single Muslim world at the time. And Seljuks also among themselves, they didn't really see eye to eye. So a different branch of the same dynasty of the Seljuks who are fighting it out further east, Baghdad area, thereabouts. And for them, crusades were not that crucial.
But they still had to fight them off when they came to take Jerusalem.
There was a garrison, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the garrison was actually, it was in negotiations, and the garrison was let go. They wanted Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not unimportant to them, but it was not crucial. And when crusaders came, and one historian compared this to kicking an open door, there were so many disagreements that there was no unified power to confront crusaders. And many cities, when crusaders passed by several of those cities, they just paid crusaders off. They gave them money, they gave them provisions, said, go to Jerusalem, just leave us alone. We don't care about you.
How unified were the crusaders? They come from all kinds of backgrounds and countries.
Our crusaders were not unified at all. No, there were several leaders. And despite the fact that they were supposed to be doing God's work, they were all supposed to be fighting for the same cause, they were ambitious men. They hustled to get ahead of each other. And for the most part, one did not join crusades to get land or to become rich. But there were some exceptions. Bohemond, for example, one of the most colorful crusaders, he wanted to get ahead with the First Crusade, definitely, in one way or another, and he became the ruler of Antioch. Antioch, which was one of the most important cities in the region. So ambitions played a major role. Disagreements happened all the time. So many in Europe thought it was a miracle that they actually managed to achieve this without actually a single leader and without having a unified plan.
Well, let's talk about other kinds of miracles when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Elizabeth Lapina, and we're looking at the Crusades, a long ongoing phenomenon that shaped the Middle Ages and a lot of history to follow, including, arguably, contemporary history. You mentioned, Elizabeth, that the Crusades were not exactly harmonious, not exactly cohesive in terms of who was calling the shots. And I would think it would be even more difficult when you had several heads of state, several kings from different countries involved in the Crusades. Who were some of those, and how did that work out?
Well, Richard the Lionheart comes to mind, of course, who went on the Third Crusade. Louis the Ninth, so for whom St. Louis is named. He was a king who went on crusades twice. Had a horrible experience both times. The first time he got captured. The second time he actually died, and his son died as well. So the First Crusade did not have any royal representatives. Well, he has some representatives from the royal families, but no kings. Then we have more and more kings going on crusades.
No, they captured Jerusalem in 1099 during the First Crusade. Mm-hmm. Why did they need a second one?
During the First Crusade, they established several Crusader states. Kingdom of Jerusalem was the most important one. There was Principality of Antioch, and there was another one, it was Tripoli, and there was another one with the capital in Edessa. And Edessa was captured. So the goal of the Second Crusade was to recapture Edessa. It was a town that was strategically important and also important for various religious reasons.
And so these crusades were to capture other places, new places, or recapture ones that had been lost?
Well, after Edessa, the Second Crusade was a disaster, so they didn't achieve anything. So after the capture of Edessa, Muslims rallied, and they rallied especially behind the figure of Saladin, who was able to unify different Muslims behind him, was able to unify Muslims of Syria and Muslims of Egypt. And he was able to reconquer Jerusalem. So Jerusalem fell, and the Third Crusade, the goal of the Third Crusade was to help the Crusader states against Saladin, who was about to destroy all of them, but also to recapture Jerusalem. And the goal of later Crusades was to recapture Jerusalem, although they began to think about it differently in later decades. So they began to think, well, we should conquer Egypt first. And from Egypt, using Egypt as a base, then conquer Jerusalem. And actually, Louis the Ninth probably overthought the whole thing because he went to what is today Tunis on a crusade, even though the goal was to capture.
It was way off course.
Capture Jerusalem.
Far to the west.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they have to wonder, too, before we get into miracles, how many of these players actually died in combat, and how many of them from other sources. I think Saladin actually died of a fever, didn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to calculate survival rates of crusaders. But just adding up the names that we know, names of people whose fates we know, about a third died on any single crusade. So 30% died mostly of diseases or complications resulting from wounds rather than actually on the battlefield. And the rest often got violently sick, got captured. So it was a horrible experience for crusaders. It was not glorious, glorious fighting. It was really, really horrific conditions for them.
And, I mean, they must have been terribly outnumbered, too, because you have these forces coming from as far away as England, in the case of Richard the Lionheart, coming to the Middle East and attacking the population that's already established there. It really does seem like it would take a miracle to pull it off.
And kings of Jerusalem were constantly sending letters to the West saying, please come, please settle here. We need manpower. We need fighters. What helped a lot was the Templars. The Templars, who were professional soldiers, but who at the same time were monks. So they dedicated their lives to fighting in the Holy Land, fighting against Muslims in the Holy Land. And they provided not only manpower, they provided funding, they provided stability, and they provided continuity. So the kings of Jerusalem relied on them to fight their battles. Of course, they had their own armies, but Templars were very, very important for the survival of Crusader states.
Did this turn into essentially siege warfare, or were there other aspects to it?
Yes, there were a lot of sieges, and Templars were very important in siege warfare. And most of the castles in the Holy Land actually eventually passed into Templar or hands of a similar military monastic order, Hospitallers, because they had the funds and they had the manpower, and they manned those castles. And with castles, actually, the weaker a state, the stronger the castles. So in the later years, Crusader castles became very, very impressive. Castles that could withstand sieges of a year or more, was self-sufficient and very, very impressive. And the reason why stronger castles mean often correlate to weaker states is because the defenders of those castles did not count on anybody coming to their aid. So they were ready to defend for as long as it was necessary.
Are these crusaders, are they building these castles when they get to the Middle East?
They're building, they're renovating old castles. But they're building quite a lot.
Okay, so the real estate market was hot for castles at that time. And the whole castle architecture phenomenon, is that pretty much an outgrowth of what Norman culture and the conflicts earlier in the 11th century in Western Europe?
Crusaders built cutting-edge castles. The best castles of the time period were probably found in the East, and they experimented quite a lot with different building designs. For example, with core-centric castles, where there's one castle with several sets of walls. So if somebody breaches one set of walls, there's another set of walls to breach.
And now about these miracles, perceived miracles, whatever your point of view, I suppose, would depend on exactly what happened. What kind of accounts do we have?
Well, the Middle Ages, one of the things that attracted to the Middle Ages, it's always a puzzle. It's all about interpreting very few sources that are also very, very biased, written from a very particular perspective. So when it comes to sources, we have chronicles written by mostly monastic authors or clerical authors. What I'm interested in my research is perceptions of Crusades, not only what happened, but what people thought about what happened, how they interpreted what happened. So I look at chansons de geste that are fictional stories related to Crusades on Crusader topics, but that are not factual.
Contemporary with the Crusades?
Contemporary with the Crusades, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they would describe a tent of a sultan that can fit 1,000 people. So clearly an exaggeration. But interesting, nonetheless, for how they saw the Muslim world, how they saw Crusades.
Well, they are fighting with the understanding that God is on their side. Is God actually performing miracles to help them out, do they think?
Well, during the First Crusade, there were several miracles that were reported. So the most important miracle was intervention of saints in battle. So they actually thought they saw several saints riding from the heavens into battle and leading them to victory. After the First Crusade, they stopped winning, and saints pretty much stopped appearing as well.
once the Crusaders are established, then what kind of lifestyle do they take? Do they go native during these long occupations in the Middle East?
It's very hard to tell from extant sources because they wanted to maintain the semblance of being Militus Christi, of fighting for Christendom, fighting for Christ. So any contacts they had with Muslims, they did not necessarily want to write home about. Also, they were interested in recruiting knights from the West, so they didn't want to tell those knights back home that they were actually quite on friendly terms with Muslims. But if you look at the sources carefully, we do find quite a lot of evidence of interactions on the ground, of quite friendly interactions on the ground. There was one author, Muslim author, who says that he went to pray in a former mosque now owned by the Templars. He went to pray there, and there was a crusader, and he was praying facing towards Mecca, of course. And there was one crusader who said, well, you shouldn't pray like this, you should pray facing east. And he violently took him and made him face east. But then the Templars came over, and they intervened and said, well, we apologize for our friend here. He just came from Europe. He doesn't know what he's doing. Just pray as you wish. So it's just one anecdote, but we do have a number of such anecdotes of more or less normal relations. We have some anecdotes about crusaders acquiring a liking for local food and for baths, going to baths. Also, crusaders realized, the elites among them, that they had more in common with Muslim elites than with their own peasants. They had the same values, revolving around military prowess, courage in battle, etc. They had very similar hobbies as well.
Hobbies.
For example, hunting. Hunting with falcons, so birding. They engaged in trade with Muslims of hunting birds. So all while crusades were going on, this was going on as well. Or we have one emperor, Frederick II, who was very interested in learning, in Muslim learning. And he actually knew Arabic. And he was maintaining a busy correspondence with his Muslim counterparts.
Well, that does raise an interesting question. There was so much learning in that part of Asia Minor that seems to have gotten credit for casting a lot of light on the Dark Ages. And was there more of this in terms of the Crusaders bringing back some of this knowledge, some of this information from the East?
Well, there were other points of contact with Muslims, such as the south of Italy and Sicily, where a large Muslim population lived under Christian rulers for over two centuries in the Middle Ages. So Sicily was the place where this intellectual contact took place. Spain was another frontier where Muslims and Christians interacted, and Christians learned from Muslims acquired some of this knowledge that was in the Muslim world was not available to Christians before. So Crusader states were not a major hub of intellectual life for whatever reason, even though, yeah, contacts still happened, different levels.
Well, is it too early to skip forward to there were how many Crusades altogether?
Eight or nine? Even though these are numbers we imposed on Crusaders. Nobody said in the Middle Ages, I'm going on the Seventh Crusade.
Were there breaks in between them?
There were breaks, but there were some campaigns that were probably larger than the Ninth Crusade. but for various historical reasons did not acquire a number. So it was a stream of people, not just knights, of people going to the east all the time. And there were major military campaigns that took place at regular intervals, and we now call crusades.
So what time span are we talking about, from 1099 until...
Well, this is a difficult question because, well, the last stronghold, Crusader stronghold, was captured by Muslims in 1291. But Crusaders still controlled Cyprus, for example. So Crusader state on Cyprus lasted well into the early modern period, and in Greece as well. So they established several states in Greece. So Crusader states persevered there as well. Also, Crusades, when we talk about Crusades, Crusades were not fought only against Muslims. We also have Crusades against pagans in what is today the Baltic region. We also have Crusades that pitted Catholics against Catholics. In Italy, for example, that had many characteristics of Crusades, only Muslims were not involved in any way.
What was the purpose of those Catholics versus Catholics then? Was it some kind of theological finer points, or was it more venal?
There were no theological differences. What the papacy believed... that the dynasty that controlled Sicily was not legitimate. So they called upon a different dynasty, on a younger brother of Louis IX, King of France, to come and conquer Sicily. And this was preached as a crusade. So the Charles of Anjou, so this younger brother, he and his soldiers acquired the same benefits, or believed they acquired the same benefits of salvation.
Martyrdom.
Martyrdom, yeah. Mm-hmm, as those who went to fight Muslims in the East. And there were no theological differences whatsoever. It was dynasty against dynasty.
Well, you've mentioned, of course, the conflict between Christians and Muslims, Christians and pagans, Christians and Christians. What about Christians and Jews? How did Jews relate to the Crusades?
Well, the first Crusade, the first blood shed by Crusaders was Jewish blood in the region of the Rhineland in Germany and in northern France as well, where Crusaders attacked Jewish communities and actually wiped out several of them. And there were different reasons why they did so. Well, they wanted to finance their crusades, so they wanted to steal the Jews' goods. But also they didn't understand why they were going to kill infidels, non-Christians in the East. But here there were infidels at home,
but
in quotation marks.
They weren't in possession of the Holy Lands, though.
Well, there was this drive to purify Jerusalem. And before you can purify Jerusalem, maybe you should purify your home of all non-Christians or bad Christians. So it's the ideology of Crusades was definitely involved in those massacres of the Jews. And it was not just the peasants who were involved in those massacres. So before, many historians said, well, it's just the mob. But actually, now we found quite a lot of knights and upper echelons of crusaders who got involved in those massacres, who were responsible for those massacres as well.
We'll look further into the history and developments subsequent to the Crusades when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Elizabeth Lapina, and we're looking at the Crusades, and in specific now, as the Crusades wind down in the late 13th century. Why? Why stop? I mean, these crusaders have invested all this time, however many, 9 crusades altogether, something like that, in trying to capture and occupy the Holy Land, Jerusalem in particular. But why after this effort and some success along the way do they stop?
It's all the fault of Louis IX. Because the Louis IX, he combined 2 characteristics. First of all, he was a true believer, clearly. He was morally upright. Nobody had any doubts about his motivations when he went on crusades. He was a true soldier of Christ. So there were good reasons why he became a saint. At the same time, he was a very good organizer. His crusades were remarkably well organized, well provisioned, well planned out. His brothers went with him. All of French aristocracy that mattered went with him. And he failed miserably. His army, much of it died. The rest was taken captive. He was ransomed for an extraordinary sum. And he died, of course, on his second crusade. So after him, people just gave up. If he couldn't succeed, who could? First of all. And second, another reason is that, well, now we have different theaters, of course, in warfare. And many people said, well, why don't we go to Italy and campaign? It's much, much closer. We'll get the same benefits. We'll fight against the Aragonese, against whom the papacy is preaching a crusade. And we don't have to risk our lives crossing the sea. And that's the second reason why crusades stopped. And also, well, France and England got engaged in something that became known as the Hundred Years' War, and it was just not a good time to go on crusades. But the French kings, they kept planning a new crusade for generation. It became a major part of the identity of French kings to proclaim their desire to go on crusades for generations after crusades, as we know them, were over.
So it's kind of just a tradition, almost lip service.
It was more than lip service. It was really part of their identity, to proclaim themselves as willing to do God's work, to fight for Christ, to sacrifice for Christ. And, of course, the pageantry of taking the cross, they were also very much on board with that.
Well, and that's one thing that we haven't mentioned is the importance of relics at this time. And owning a piece of the life of Christ or one of the saints.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Even though most crusaders did not bring home any valuables, crusades was not a good way to become rich. But they did bring back home lots of relics. And those relics could be very different. For example, if you were a peasant and you went to the Holy Land, you would bring back some soil from the Holy Land in perhaps a flask. And there was an entire industry producing all sorts of flasks that you could buy close to the Holy Sepulchre and bring back home. And, of course, if you're higher up, you would bring home maybe the relic of the true cross, which Christ was crucified. So, yeah, there was a flow, a major, major flow of relics from the East to the West. And a major boost to this flow of relics was the Fourth Crusade, when crusaders also wanted to go to Egypt to then conquer Jerusalem, but instead they ended up taking over Constantinople, by far the largest and the wealthiest Christian city in the world at the time. And it was full of relics that made their way to the east. And Saint-Chapelle in Paris was built to house some of those relics from Constantinople.
Once the Crusades wind down, how is all of that energy refocused in Western Europe? Is it funneled into nationalism? We've been talking about France and we've mentioned Germany and Italy, but those were not complete countries in the current sense. They were all smaller states. Where does all the energy go? What's the kind of the next phase of European development?
Well, it was the French who took the lead with Crusades, beginning with the Second Crusade. And the French were, of course, engaged in the Hundred Years' War. And that's mostly where their
against
England, yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that changed with Crusades is attitude towards warfare. It became much easier to proclaim certain types of warfare as not just, but more than just, as a sacred duty. And that went into internationalism, that went into, especially the nationalism developed during the Hundred Years' War.
And what happens to knighthood by this time?
Well, knights were very much engaged in the Hundred Years' War until the development of cannons. Of course, knights were very much involved in warfare. So knights didn't go any way after the First Crusade. And what did knights do? They also developed all this mythology about their crusader ancestors, and they also made the show of taking the cross and promising to go on a crusade along with the French monarchy.
So what kinds of things are being written by people about the Crusades by the time they end, circa, 1300?
Well, we still have those chansons that develop.
Are they romanticized?
They're still romanticized, very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. We have chronicles that are written and that are rewritten because that are translated and translated very freely. So we have this work of memory, of remembering the Crusades. And, of course, in the Middle Ages, all manuscripts are copied. But every time you copy a manuscript, you change things around. Also, there's a development of vernacular literature. So we have a lot of chronicles, not in Latin, but in Old French about the Crusades become available quite widely. So this memory of Crusades is very, very important in Europe throughout the later Middle Ages.
Even though they failed, I mean, is it fair to say that the Crusades failed? And if they didn't fail, what did they accomplish?
Well, that's not how they saw it. Well, they saw it as a temporary setback. They focused on the First Crusade that was successful. They thought that this would be repeated, and of course, they had to win in the end. They believed that they were being punished for their sins, that once they get their act together, they'll go back and they will conquer Jerusalem, just as the First Crusade conquered Jerusalem. So they didn't see the failure as such. It's a temporary setback.
And how does the image of the Crusades then change over the course of time? I mean, we get these fairly romanticized versions early on. At what point do we maybe see it more in terms of what happened as opposed to the idealized version?
Well, with Protestantism, we have a lot of backlash against the papacy, of course, and all of papacy's projects, including, of course, the Crusades that were papacy's projects. So we see early modern historians writing from the Protestant perspective and being very critical of Crusades as papal folly. So this is the beginning of a more critical attitude towards Crusades.
And in terms of actually developing histories of what happened, going back and finding out the documents, what do the Muslim sources have to say about the Crusades?
Well, first of all, Muslim sources have been understudied. So Crusades have been studied primarily from Western perspective. So this is the new wave of scholarship that will come in will be Crusades from a Muslim perspective. And much of the time, Muslim authors were not concerned about Crusades, as I mentioned. They were more concerned about the Mongols, about the real, the big threat. For most of the period, Crusader states were fairly minor enclaves that Muslims traded with, that they fought against, yes, of course, but they were not that very important for the Muslim world. So yes, we have Muslim sources, but Crusades were never as central to the Muslim world as they were to Western Europe.
Are there questions about the Crusades that have yet to be answered, do you think?
Well, as with all history, each generation asks new questions and looks at them from a new perspective. Because, for example, today we've been talking about knights quite a lot. What were women doing in Crusades? Why did women go on Crusades? Peasants on Crusades, or lower ranked soldiers, their view of Crusades. Archaeology ongoing in Israel, as well, especially, is uncovering quite a lot about daily life in Crusader states. So it's quite a lot of questions to be answered, especially since we do have few sources. So in addition of each new source, can change the picture quite dramatically.
And these were overland routes that were taken primarily from Western Europe to the Middle East.
They went overland during the First Crusade and during the Second Crusade. And they had a horrible time crossing Anatolia. Establishing supply lines was a nightmare. Well, it was impossible. So they would starve for a couple of weeks each time they went, at least for a couple of weeks. So by the Third Crusade, shipbuilding was advanced enough so that they would sail. Finally, they started sailing. It was quite complicated, lots of problems to resolve. For example, how to transport horses, so they wouldn't hurt themselves during a storm. So actually horses were sort of strapped up and were hanging from the ceiling so that they wouldn't hurt their legs. So by the time of the Third Crusade, they were sailing. And often they were stopping on Cyprus, provisioning there, or sometimes Sicily, provisioning there, and then going to wherever they were going.
Well, it was, I'm sure, viewed by some as a great adventure, too, and a way to either attain spiritual benefit or, in some cases, you've mentioned some cases, financial benefit. But it certainly has left its imprint on European history, and some of the language is still with us today in the Middle East and those conflicts that we see. There's reference to Crusaders even now. Elizabeth Lapina, thank you for giving us some insights into that large-scale phenomenon, the Crusades. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.